This is the Farming for a Better Climate podcast.
My name is Seamus Murphy. I'm an environmental consultant at SAC Consulting. And tonight I'm joined by agricultural consultant Robert Ramsey. Robert, what's keeping you busy?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Seamus. Lots at the moment. So we are in, our job runs in pretty, you know, big cycles throughout the year. And we're in certainly in the biggest one, which is the IAX period. So we're just tailing off with IAX. It's been really good to be back in the office. So we're back in the office and seeing farmers face to face again. The last couple of years we've been doing that virtually. Yeah. And it's really great to be back.
It's probably a good time then to ask you what's the general feeling.
Yeah, so I think I've had just a handful of farmers who've not mentioned fertilizer in the first 2 minutes of our conversation. So it's certainly inflation of all costs, and but there's people are under pressure that things are changing. And I think we need to keep in mind as farmers, we've asked for change for a long, long time. You know, we've all said it, that things are going to need to change. Now it's changing and we don't necessarily like it. So for me, I think we just have to deal with the bumpy road that's probably in front of us just now and see where it goes, because it is, we are in a time where commodities are inflating and we're generally producing commodities. So if we can control costs, you know, there's options there. So certainly there's a lot of good conversations about that. We also get, you know, invariably the IAX conversations comes round to, can I get a grant for insert question here. So this year the grant opportunities are relatively limited, but pretty good opportunities if they fit. So there are, the Sustainable Agriculture Capital Grant Scheme is open again with a focus on slurry. So there's a lot of people, really the dribble bar. So I'm based in Ayrshire at Auchengrove. So very much a grassland area and a big dairy area. So there's a lot of slurry and a lot of people certainly looking to take advantage of those grants. So it's been interesting. And then obviously the new opportunities emerging for through the national test program with soil analysis and carbon audits are also quite an interesting conversation. So we've, through IAX, we've actually had a lot of good conversations, which will, it'll get us work and keep us on farm for the next few months through the summer.
Going back to the national test program, what's the kind of general feeling then with regard to the carbon footprints and the soil carbon? I assume a lot of the farmers you're coming across will have already gotten, had one carbon footprint carried out.
Yeah, so it's interesting that most people's attitude to carbon audits now, they have changed. So the first one a lot of them did was through the beef efficiency scheme, which was a pilot scheme to start with. It was well intentioned, and certainly it would be, you know, there was some issues in that scheme, and you know, it was early days, and we were really baseline auditing people. Some of them were doing their own audit. It was a starter for 10, but now people are into their second or even third carbon audit. They're really getting a handle on it and now getting pretty interested in it as a way of digging into their business, grant funded to have a deep dig into the business and look at where you're inefficient. And I always try and bring it back to, yes, it's all about carbon, but most of these inefficiencies, the vast majority of them, have a massive financial bearing as well. So if we can make a saving on the carbon end of things, the farmer might not be bothered about that. Most of them are quite engaged in it, but the thing that's driving most of them is actually a profitable business. And the thing we always have to keep in mind is you can't, you know, the old story that a business in the red can't go green. So if you're in debt, if you're struggling financially, basically, I think our role is to make sure we keep these farmers in farms, keep them farming, and then give them the tools they need to become, you know, more efficient and more environmentally sensitive.
Yeah, I think we found that with the Focus Farms and Farm for a Better Climate and the Soil Regen Group as well. The first carbon footprint doesn't really tell you much. It gives you a nice snapshot in time, but it's really when you start getting your third, fourth, fifth carbon footprint, that's when you can start to really take action.
You know, it's also worth saying the first carbon audit I did was for Woodhead Climate Change Focus Farm, and that was in 2014. And in that time, I've got a lot better at doing it. The tool has got a lot better, and our understanding of all that it means has improved. And I think that's company-wide, that we've all got a lot better at it. And now we can do the audit quite efficiently, so we can spend more time actually doing the important bit, which is feeding back to the farmer and telling, you know, to, trying to help make improvements rather than showing them where the problems are. It's giving them the tools to deal with them.
Yeah, it is one of these things, carbon, when we're talking about the carbon audit and getting that done on the farm, there's that element of it and reducing emissions that way, but there is also this other huge part of it that's growing in the kind of consciousness of farmers, I'd say, when we're looking at carbon markets and how farmers and land managers can use carbon markets to make themselves more financially sustainable. Are you finding that as well?
Yeah, so it's a funny one because of the way the rate of growth in that market and the what it's done in rural areas, you know, it really has changed the face of many communities. Just, you know, there's some big stories out there of multinational companies that have got involved, and you know, there's a lot of farmers with a bitter taste in their mouth about, you know, carbon markets, carbon credits, and actually, you know, I can see where they're coming from, and I know we'll discuss that later on, but there's an opportunity to get involved here as well. We've got the asset that everyone else is looking for in land, so there are farmers and individuals who have a major opportunity here, and we all have an opportunity or perhaps a need down the line to engage in this process. So I think we need to be cautious. I know a lot of farmers would like it banned and like it, you know, they're the ones who don't want any sort of change, but I think there's a huge reason to be optimistic as a farmer at the moment.
As you mentioned there, Robert, the carbon markets are quite a novel thing for agriculture. In farming, they're quite new, but in forestry they've been around for a long time, and there's a lot of expertise in forestry that knows a lot more about carbon markets. And to help us bridge that gap tonight, we've asked Ben Law, a forestry consultant at SSE Consulting, to come along to help kind of explain bits and pieces about carbon markets that he's learned over the years working in forestry. So Ben, welcome.
Seamus, Robert, thank you for having me.
Do you want to give us a bit of background, Ben? Just tell us a bit about yourself.
Absolutely. So my name is Ben. I'm one of the senior forestry consultants with SAC Consulting. I'm based in Inverness, and I've been with the company for a couple of years now, working in all aspects of the forestry market, from woodland creation, environmental impact assessments, delivery of forests, and management of them right through to harvesting, and then starting the whole cycle again.
Good stuff. So I suppose the first question, the most obvious question to ask, is what is a carbon credit?
So a carbon credit, in its simplest form, is a method to quantify and assign the ownership of one metric ton of carbon dioxide equivalent, which has been removed from the atmosphere, in the form of a certificate, or better known as a credit. It's a method to quantify carbon capture and assign the ownership of it, and that then enables the measurable offsetting of an individual or a company's emissions. And that also facilitates the trading of these through a carbon market.
Okay. The carbon sequestered, in terms of forestry, that's the carbon sequestered by X amount of trees that has to equate to a ton of CO2 equivalent.
Essentially, yeah. So the carbon capture, the calculations behind the scenes are quite extensive. It runs to the tree growth rates, the species, the planting densities they put in the ground at.
Yeah.
What the soil regime is, and everything else in between, as it were, we cover a huge number of variables. Okay. But the long and short of it is, how much does the tree capture in its lifespan?
Yeah.
And how long are you measuring for?
And then the credits will be awarded, and then the company will come along and they'll want to offset their emissions. So the market then is there to support that kind of transaction occurring. So how does that work? How does the process of the carbon market work then?
Exactly. So the market itself is simply a way of matching buyers of carbon and sellers of carbon units. In the UK, all of the forestry schemes are going through the Woodland Carbon Code. This is the market we use for forestry schemes. It's a quality assurance standard, and it makes sure that all the schemes we deliver are delivered to that quality code, that they are delivered in the right means, and they're delivered at the right timescale. And it gives confidence to the market and in the units that are being generated. With every scheme that goes on to the market, as it were, through the Woodland Carbon Code, there is a buffer element of that. So you can never sell the full 100% of the carbon you're generating. There's always an element of caution in there. There's always an element of buffer that's been applied. And that's to protect individual schemes against falling short of what they actually may deliver. And that might be as a result of, like you say, it might be a pest or disease issue, a growth issue in the crop. It might be a changing climate. It might be we have a changing climate that no longer suits the tree species we're planting now in 40, 50 years' time.
And then how is it all priced? How is the that unit of carbon, that credit, how is that priced by the market?
So the pricing is essentially treated as a commodity. So it's supply and demand of carbon units.
Okay.
When this first scheme started up 10 or 11 years ago, we were seeing very little supply and very little demand, as it were. That's really accelerated after the Paris Agreement in terms of the climate change agreement of setting a 1.5 degree target, but also after COP26. So the demand, therefore, for offsetting, the awareness of commercial organizations, but also consumers as well, of the need to offset carbon in order to protect the climate, has driven this demand for carbon offsetting.
Yeah.
This is combined with the drive we have for increased woodland creation planting across the UK, trying to bring our woodland cover in line with the rest of Europe. And the two have combined to really drive the market forwards. Pricing is really subjective. So a native scheme that delivers multiple benefits and is very much aligned with the buyer's viewpoint, as it were, in terms of what they want to deliver, may well have a far higher price than a less diverse scheme. Certainly, from the very outset, we've seen the carbon prices paid for commercial conifer plantations being substantially lower than the values generated by native broadleaves. And that's down to market trends.
Yeah. What Robert was talking about at the start was this land has been bought up by millionaires. That then it has just been driven by the market, driven by the demand for more carbon credits.
It's certainly helping the demand in the market there in terms of the carbon prices. The green layered movement that is being publicized so strongly just now and is causing so much concern. Oftentimes carbon is just a secondary benefit for these schemes.
Yeah.
The majority of the very large schemes we'll see going through to date are based on timber prices. Timber as a commodity is rising in value dramatically. Certainly from values 10 years ago, we've seen huge jumps in value. And forestry as an investment is seen as a safe investment.
Yeah.
It's treated favorably within the tax system. It's got good returns. And certainly it's been far more desirable in the past 2 years with COVID than commercial real estate, which is one of the other big investment opportunities in the UK.
I think at the back of it as well, you know, you've got that. And when times are tough, people buy gold and land, and that's, you know, that's happened for centuries. So it's happened now. People are moving money from, you know, funds or whatever, in you know, the big business world. They're taking money from there and buying land. And as it stands just now, the fashionable thing to do with land is to plant it in trees. So I would agree. I think, you know, that it's multifactorial why these decisions are being made isn't purely down to carbon credits. It probably is the headline story because we don't fully understand it as farmers, you know, don't fully get what it's all about. I think there is, if you forgive me for being that welly-wearing farmer for a minute, there is an issue I can see with fundamentally what we're trying to do is reverse or slow down climate change. We're actually trying to do the job right here. And I do wonder whether carbon credits, certainly in the wrong hands, are an excuse to continue with what we've been doing all along. As a species, we have to stop consuming stuff and burning stuff. That there's a bigger issue here, and I think the carbon credit story will help and it gets the ball rolling, but there's so much more work needed done than just buy them, job done, keep doing what you're doing.
I think just on that, I think that is becoming more of an important area for companies. Essentially, they will have to reduce their emissions to to a point where they cannot reduce anymore and then offset. That seems to be the way these things are going, to try and stop just a company saying, right, business as usual, and we'll offset, and it's fine. That's not fine anymore, or it won't be fine in the future. There's one element that I did want to ask about as well, was this additionality and the idea of additionality, which is similar kind of to what Robert has spoken about there. Can you explain what additionality means in terms of carbon credits?
I'll do my best. So additionality, trying to explain it in a simple manner is challenging, because it's a difficult concept to get your head around, especially when you're applying it to woodland creations or other schemes, including peatland restoration as well. Mm. The long and short of it is you're looking to see that the carbon you are capturing, the capture would not have happened without the funding that you've given it.
Yep.
You have to prove unequivocally that the carbon funding you are generating is paying for this benefit. If the woodland creation, the peatland restoration, or any other project you're investing in would have gone ahead with or without your money, then you can argue that it's not additional. Mm-hmm. It would have happened anyway. So you don't actually have that credibility of the unit, because the change wasn't caused by your payment. And this is why we need the confidence in the market that's generated by additionality, that we've passed a test to prove that the scheme being delivered needed the carbon funding to happen.
That's essentially because the carbon market is there so that we can achieve the sequestration or emissions reduction that we need, that has to be kind of additional to what will have already happened. Because we know that if we want to achieve 1.5 degrees or limit warming to 1.5 degrees, we need to take in more carbon. So we need more of these kind of projects that are sequestering carbon. But we only want to be paying for the ones that wouldn't have happened otherwise. That's essentially kind of the reasoning behind that, isn't it?
Absolutely. There's been various attempts at carbon schemes across the globe in recent years and in longer term as well. Australia has been through the press recently and getting quite bad light of it for schemes that didn't have the same level of scrutiny that some of ours do.
Yeah.
So the Woodland Carbon Code has been portrayed as a gold standard, as it were. It has been ISO accredited. It has a number of accreditations it's gone through. ICRO is one. And it is seen very much as being constantly renewed to ensure that there is a credible delivery of units there. The Australian schemes and some others across the world as well, there were landowners getting paid for not cutting down trees or for planting trees that were never delivered. Mm. It's why we have such a stringent standard in the UK, is to make sure that we are delivering what we're promising.
We get asked quite a lot about, you know, grass and hedgerows and things on farm, and you know, why we can't sell carbon credits from grassland that sequesters carbon. And, you know, grass grows for 10 months of the year and a tree only grows for five. And there's all these stories there that, you know, they're fact-based, but the reality of, you know, what we're saying there about additionality, about the carbon credit story, is anybody offered, you know, money for grassland sequestration, or we should be very, very cautious before getting involved in any of these schemes because they're pretty ropey. The thing we should do, though, that's not to say farming isn't doing its bit. There's a good story to tell out there with grassland sequestration, rotational grazing, and things we can do as farmers to actually make these ruminant, mostly ruminant systems look an awful lot better on paper. You know, and that's a real positive for farmers.
The caution, I think, is the key message. There is a lot of development going on in the background for a soil carbon code to emerge later this year, hopefully. And we may well see the same for farm carbon, for blue carbon, which is ocean sequestered carbon via kelp and others. Until there is an established code, though, and there's a quality assurance standard that goes with this, I'd very much stress caution before entering into any agreement for these, because you may well be double selling, you may well be selling something that doesn't exist.
I think as well, in the ruminant world, you might also be selling something that's totally legitimate that you need yourself. You know, if you've sold that, if you've sequestered carbon somewhere, you've done something to mitigate your own emissions, if you sell that credit, you no longer have the right to claim anything against it. So we need to be squeaky clean with this, because all our businesses are going to be more and more scrutinised down the line through carbon auditing and probably funding down the line.
I think the key to a lot of it is that not all carbon credits are created equal. In terms, there are some really, really good schemes out there. The Woodland Carbon Code and the Peatland Code would be two of them that we know of. And then when we're talking about kind of soil carbon at the moment, you know, the soil carbon code is being developed, but at the moment it's probably less secure, kind of less robust, I would argue. But that isn't to say that in the future there may not be a completely robust, viable market for that, but we're just not there yet, I don't think.
Certainly, until an established code is released and a quality assurance standard that backs it, I would strongly advise against selling soil carbon or anything that is not going through an accredited scheme. Mm-hmm. Like you say, until it's verified, there's far too much risk there.
And just on the idea of additionality that we mentioned previously, there has been some changes recently to the Woodland Carbon Code, and additionality does factor into some of those changes. Isn't that right?
It does indeed. So last week, there were two updates to the UK schemes. The Peatland Carbon Code release version 1.2, which is their new updated standard. Mm-hmm. The Woodland Carbon Code release version 2.2, which is their, again, new updated standard. The standard was only released on Friday of last week.
Yeah.
So a lot of the industry is still very much coming to terms with this. But some of the major changes that have been made to the Woodland Carbon Code are that of additionality.
Okay.
There is far closer scrutiny and far more tightening of the restrictions, as it were, to ensure that schemes are unequivocally additional. Land value has been removed from the equation. Standard costs have been applied to many of the aspects that are involved in the calculations behind the scheme. And the scrutiny that's been applied to schemes now is far tighter. And this is, it's in, the intention is to ensure the credibility of the units ongoing. The carbon credits and the codes behind them will constantly evolve as the market matures. There will always be these changes to the codes that will come through for every code across the industry. And the drive behind this is to really make sure that these units are absolute, that there is no question brought into them, and to really maintain the faith that the investors in the market has in the delivery of these units.
So it may well be a positive move in terms of the carbon credits. Are we at a stage yet where the Woodland Carbon Code could support, say, the creation of maybe smaller agroforestry, or even these shelter belts, or things that are riparian woodland that maybe don't fall under the kind of standard grant schemes that are available?
So certainly in recent years, we have been using the Woodland Carbon Code and the carbon credits we can generate through sales on that market to supplement the forestry grant scheme in Scotland. The scheme we have through the forestry grant scheme, which is Scottish Government funding, it is a finite pot of money.
Yeah.
It is heavily competed for. There is a lot of applications to this every year. We are oversubscribed this year already for Woodland targets. And certainly the way the schemes have been set up, it supports economy of scale. So the larger the scheme, the less complex it is in terms of fencing areas around. If it's one perimeter fence, it's more economically viable under the forestry grant scheme alone. Mm-hmm. And because of the way the grant schemes are modelled, it's paid on a linear or a hectareage rate. So for schemes that are quite fractured, you've got individual blocks as opposed to one large plantation.
Yeah.
It's more difficult to make the costs stack up. So certainly in recent years, we've been developing a lot of schemes that have been integrating into farms very efficiently. And these are the riparian zones that we're planting. It's the shelter belts on arable and livestock farms.
Yeah.
It's the planting of field margins and rougher ground that is poaching or causing livestock issues, and improving biosecurity on farms as well by separating units. Up until the change in the code, that's certainly the way it had worked very efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
It made these schemes possible. And we're yet to see how version 2.2, the Woodland Carbon Code, works for these schemes.
I think it highlights an issue. You know, farming, you know, it is at the moment we're kind of pitched farming versus forestry. You know, it's a one or the other. And I can, you know, hand on heart, the vast majority of people that have been through my office in the last 6 weeks are all pro. You know, many people ask, can we get, is there a grant available for a hectare block, a shelter belt, hedges, all this type of stuff? And, you know, I hope it does evolve into somewhere that we can get more integration onto farms, because if you look at how most of these farms are made up, there's quite a lot of woodland already, or certainly in a lot of areas, there's quite a lot of woodland already incorporated. Some of that's needing maintained, and a lot of it's needing expanded. And I think there's a real appetite there, and we would get a lot of buy-in if we can get more small schemes. But I appreciate that's where the problem is you've got so much capital tied up for a relatively small small impact. But certainly, you know, we could get a few hectares on most farms to the benefit of the farm.
Certainly that's the message we've been pushing quite strongly in recent years, and it's one we emphasize every opportunity we get. As foresters, we don't want to see whole farm planting. We want to see integrated farm forestry, where we see the benefits for agriculture and for forestry delivered from the same site. We're a small island. We have one of the lowest forestry covers in Europe, certainly, with only 13% of forest cover at present compared to an average of 40% in Europe. We had far higher, but that figure of forest cover, as it were, dropped to the low point of 5% in 1919. And this is driven by industry, it was driven by wars, it was driven by a small nation needing to really prioritise food supply and food security. And we've come full circle, we're in the same position again. We really need to make sure we have the security we need for our food supplies and also for industry as well. The challenge we've had is that forestry takes far longer to establish and grow. It takes 30, 40 years for a crop to establish. So we are very much dependent on imports for our timber supply. And if we are looking at a bigger picture here, in terms of if we are looking to decarbonize our housing stock, if we're looking to move away from our reliance on steel and concrete, for example, and our reliance on importing timber from other countries, including Russia, then we need to supply that market more domestically. And in terms of land use across the UK, there's always been a land use conflict there because we're a small nation. But without integrating trees into farms in an efficient way that delivers for both sides of the sector, then we're not going to hit our planting targets and we're not going to have enough land for what we need to deliver.
I had a fantastic conversation with a farmer. It was a kind of one, the customer's always right, you've got to keep that in mind. This guy was having a real rant about tree planting, and I have to admit I fully engaged in that rant as well. So we had a good conversation there. And basically, to sum up, it was ridiculous how many farms were getting planted in trees. And literally the next thing he started talking about was the price of stabs, fencing materials through the roof, and there's not enough wood. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, wanting to have our cake and eat it here.
Absolutely. I mean, the key aspect to bear in mind is that although there is a lot in the press just now of green lairds and whole farms being bought up and planted, it's not a trend we're actually seeing within the industry just now. This is a very small sample size that's being grossly inflated. The average scheme size going through just now through the forestry grant schemes, less than 30 hectares. That's a 26 hectare scheme is the average size now for Scotland. Whilst there are obviously the behemoth schemes going through, there's a lot of this integrated forestry that we're seeing now. We're seeing the shelter belts, we're seeing the farm woodlands coming in. But we're also seeing an aging industry. We're seeing a lot of farmers looking at retirement or future planning, and a lot of them, they want to maintain ownership of the land because they've had this for four generations or more, but they can't physically stay in the game for much longer. So they're looking for a way they can keep the income, keep the land, but reduce their workload, as it were. And a lot of the times, this is where we're seeing people looking to plant trees.
Food security is vital. Climate change, I think there's no doubt, certainly among any of us, that we really need to do something there. The biodiversity story is getting a lot of, you know, it's getting a lot of traction, particularly at the Scottish Government level. And certainly farmers and landowners, we're all keen to do our part. But does the carbon credit planting, you know, those big schemes that have been planted, how much does biodiversity come into that? Is that an important part of the, you know, is there a commitment in there to have a positive biodiversity story, or do you think we're missing a trick, missing part of the, a really important link in the chain?
So with any woodland creation scheme in Scotland, we have to abide by the UK Forestry Standard. And this is our code of practice, as it were. It's the Bible for forestry in the UK. And any scheme that is planted in Scotland and the UK now has to abide by this standard. This sets out what we can and can't do, and this includes buffering and protecting water supplies, water courses. It includes the maximum species composition we can use for sites. So you won't see 100% sitka spruce plantations on hillsides anymore that were very much prevalent in the 70s and 80s. There is always an element now of a requirement for open ground, for mixed species, for native broadleafs in every scheme. And we're seeing that coming through. So more and more frequently, we're seeing diverse woodlands being delivered. Mm. And this is what we're certainly encouraging from our side as foresters and advisors for land agents and for landowners, is to integrate and to diversify your woodlands where you can. So if you're looking for timber, plant a timber reserve, absolutely. Build something that will deliver you saw logs in the future, that will supply fencing materials whilst they're getting thinned in early years, but also deliver timber beams for the housing of the next generation and a substantial income from it as well. But also look at what else you can deliver. Can you plant native broadleaves that will provide vital habitat for flora and fauna in the UK? With the woodland planting we're doing, we're seeing species moving back into areas that have been derelict for far too long. Mm-hmm. Inherently, there's a control element that comes in with the woodland creations as well. Perhaps we control a pest that's been running rampant on the hillsides for too long, but deer being one of the key ones. In terms of how the carbon market fits into this, to date, it's always been a case of the UKFS standard has to be abided by. What we've seen with the new code that was released last week is there's now an emphasis on the social and environmental benefits as well as schemes. So this is now really starting to kick in. We're seeing a stacking of benefits coming through, and biodiversity will be one of those that's focused on very much more in the future.
There is we're obviously focusing on carbon credits today, but there is a kind of conversations about how we can quantify something that like biodiversity, how we can put a price on that, and maybe not. Today or tomorrow, but maybe at some time in the future, we'll see biodiversity credits and companies offsetting damage that they've done through purchasing biodiversity credits, where a project has been carried out just to for the benefit of biodiversity. And these things are the kind of things that large kind of international companies are already talking about, like the gold standard and these kind of things. They're already looking into how these things can be developed, so they are coming.
The one on that I think is a bit of a shame is, you know, in the forestry grant scheme there is an agroforestry element, but actually making those schemes pay is nigh on impossible. And does it all come down to money? No, it doesn't. But when we're trying to run a farm business, when we're trying to do, you're looking at your options, thinking agroforestry to allow grazing and incorporating stock within those trees, which I would argue, I think most would argue, is probably the most biodiverse, most, you know, the best habitat. Trying to get that scheme in to actually cover its costs is really tough going, and actually trying to make any money out is probably impossible. So hopefully in any new iteration of the forestry grant scheme or you know, as the thing progresses and evolves, I hope we can see more of that. Because again, there's an appetite among farmers to get involved in that. We get asked about it a lot, and then we show them the figures and they say, no, not so much, not yet. So hopefully through time we can get into that world.
Absolutely. We've seen the diverse benefits that can be offered by agroforestry. We've seen it working incredibly well in Europe. France, for example, has fantastic agroforestry schemes where you've got not just livestock production integrated amongst trees, but also crops and grain. We've seen this work in England as well, where their grant scheme has been more flexible to enable agroforestry. Unfortunately, the Scottish model is just too restrictive just now. But as you say, Robert, maybe when the new scheme kicks off in 24, we'll see a change in policy there, or change in the rules and restrictions that makes agroforestry far more deliverable.
Great. And just finally then, Ben, I suppose, what would you say to farmers, land managers that are listening here? What should they be prepared for in terms of carbon credits, the evolving markets, and forestry, your own kind of area of expertise?
In terms of what to be prepared for, I think we've already seen some of the changes coming through to date. So we've now had the National Test Program released. Mm-hmm. I think that's a sign of more to come. We're seeing more scrutiny being placed on every industry, but farming in particular, looking at what our emissions are. And it's a natural assumption to make that we will see a requirement to offset these in the future. We're already seeing this in some elements of finance, some elements of supply chains, where we're looking to offset the carbon emissions generated by these. So how to plan for the future? Well, start looking early. Look at your land. If you have areas that are unproductive, if you have areas that are requiring a huge amount of input, be it fertilizer, or drainage, or maintenance, or management, maybe these areas are the ones you need to start considering as to, is this your best land use? Where can you integrate trees into your property? Or any other land use for that matter. It doesn't have to be trees. There are other improvements you can make to your systems. But certainly introduce efficiencies wherever you can. It's a very difficult sector to make a margin in. So improve your efficiencies wherever possible and take full advantage of the grant support available for you to do so. And in terms of forestry, we're always going to need trees. We can't live on plastics alone. We're always going to need natural fibre, be it for housing stock, which is a growing concern, or it might well be for fuel or for any other fibre use as well. A lot of the products we produce in farming get shipped around the world on wooden pallets or in tatty boxes or any other variety of timber-based product. So it's a linked industry. It's not one or the other. It needs to be both.
Yeah. I think that's the key from what you both said. It doesn't have to be forestry or farming. It can be forestry and farming. Thanks very much for that, Ben.
Brilliant. Thanks for having me.
So, Robert, what did you think of that chat?
Yeah, it's always good. And I think the job I'm in, so I'm a farmer, and you know, farming is very close to my heart, but the job we're in, we do have to look at the big picture as well. And I think what Ben's saying there, I think it's quite reassuring actually, that some of the bad stories we're hearing or we've heard, there are plans and there's control mechanisms out there to try and make more good stories than bad stories. And I just see it all as, you know, at the moment, farmers are being, you know, there's quite a lot of negativity out there, and all I can really see is opportunity. You know, across the board, there is endless opportunity for landowners, and it's not to necessarily to go and plant your farm. It's not to double your suckler cow numbers there's just opportunities no matter where you look, really, to do, be in control of your own destiny and take your business where you want to go.
It's interesting what Ben was saying about the actual size of plantations. You know, the average size is kind of about 30 hectares really, and it's not the story, or it's not the highlight that you're getting when you're reading The Guardian or any kind of these papers. There is that focus on the green laird, and it does seem to be the exception rather than the rule.
I would say though, I mean, a 30 hectare block is still quite a significant change in a landscape.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at it, it's
sure.
You know, effectively it's the guts of 100 acres. It's what used to be a farm. You know, it used to be most farms in Ayrshire anyway were 80 to 100 acres historically. So, you know, it is still a sizable scheme, but, you know, it is good to hear. Obviously, when there's an average, there's an awful lot of schemes that are below that as well. So bits and pieces here and there. And if we can, you know, I think that's where farmers need to engage in this story rather than turn your back on it and don't, you know, don't try and influence anyone. If we can get involved, you know, we can focus these schemes onto poorer or less productive agricultural land, and in that case, everyone wins.
Yeah, and it does kind of come back. I know that we focus mainly on forestry there, but So we have the peatland cord, we have the woodland carbon cord, and we have the soil carbon cord kind of coming down the line. And it's interesting to hear that, like, those are the kind of really robust, they're the scientifically proven schemes. But there are these other kind of schemes and these kind of things that are out there that they're not up to that level of kind of scrutiny. Are you finding that when you're chatting to farmers?
Yeah, that's definitely, it's, you know, where there's a market, where there's a booming market, there's opportunity for everybody, whether that's the totally squeaky clean, absolutely science driven scheme or the opportunist. And there certainly are, you know, there's questions, particularly around grassland, there are often questions about people, you know, asking, is this an opportunity? Is this, should I take this a 20, 30 quid a hectare, whatever it's going to be? And, you know, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And in a lot of cases, these things where you're getting told, you know, a bit of a snapshot of ropey science and then a financial opportunity, you know, we need to be really cautious before we jump into anything here. And you know, if it's not, why would we enter into this market at the bottom end? Why would you not aim for the gold standard end of things, where ultimately where the money is as well, where it's harder work, but where the money is, and where you're not going to sign yourself into a contract that ultimately the science isn't robust and you're going to land up with egg on your face.
Yeah, well, that's it. You know, I suppose that's what the companies that are going to buy these things will want. You know, they'll be willing to pay the good companies that are, as you said, as you kind of pointed out, getting to the bottom, getting to reducing their emissions as much as they can, and then offsetting what's left. Those guys are going to want to buy the best credits, the most robust credits that are available to offset their emissions. So it's going to be natural that those credits are going to cost more. So there's potentially more money to be paid there. But maybe that's a topic we can pick up on in the next episode.
Yeah, sounds good.
Thanks very much for coming on, Robert.
No, a pleasure. Thanks, Seamus.
For more information on everything that you heard tonight on carbon credits and carbon markets, please visit the Farming for a Better Climate website. There's also plenty of information on the Farm Advisory Service website too. Thanks for listening.